What they have you doing, or can't you say?
No, I can talk about my duties within reason, Jeff said. The only danger is I'd bore you to death.
I'm listening.
Trust me, it wasn't glamorous. He filled her in on his years at the company, telling her he'd held no illusions when he was recruited for the position. Government work is government work, but I figured it couldn't possibly be worse than academia. I was wrong. Though the threat to the internet was real enough, at that time it was considered to be largely abstract. The company budget was allocated primarily to the traditional physical threats. When it came to computers and the internet, the threat was generally perceived as the possible physical destruction of facilities. As their primary mission, Jeff and his truncated team worked on recovering data from computers seized from suspects and known terrorists. But they were also responsible for tracking the use of the internet for terrorist activities and for potential threats. During the years of his employment, as the internet grew and spread its tentacles into every aspect of American life and the world community, the potential for a cyber terrorist attack rose exponentially. The safety of the internet, and of those computers connected to it, was dependent solely on the security of each individual computer that formed part of the network. Jeff had certainly seen the threat. He had reasoned that as more government agencies conducted both external and internal business through the internet, as more banks came online, as nuclear power plants continued linking to one another, and as the U.S. military came to increasingly rely on the internet and computers to conduct its operations, his unit would receive greater resources and command more attention. He'd been wrong. The irony was that the internet had originally been developed as a national security system. In the 1960s, the Department of Defense had been concerned about the vulnerability of its mainframe computers, back in the days when all computers were mainframes, and of its increasingly computer-linked communication system. Several well-placed ICBMs, or even one at a critical point, could potentially cripple America's ability to defend itself. The Air Force was especially concerned about maintaining real-time control over its nuclear missiles. What then emerged was a government-funded system of interconnected computer redundancy. The idea was that even if several computer hubs at key installations were nuked, the system, the actual internet, would reroute itself around them. In theory, like the multi-headed Hydra of Greek mythology, it would be impossible to defeat. It might be slow, it might electronically hiccup, but the system would function. Jeff wasn't so sure. The designers had only considered outside threats. They'd never contemplated the ultimate digital universe they'd created, or that the real threat to the internet might well come from within. Although the internet had proven itself enormously popular with the worldwide community and had become increasingly vital to the lives of individuals and the welfare of Fortune 500 companies, interest in safeguarding it wasn't as high as it ought to be. Jeff was convinced that it would take a significant failure of the system or a coordinated cyber attack to awaken everyone. Just as it had been impossible to put the United States on a proper war footing before Pearl Harbor, the same fate seemed to await the future of internet security. No one liked being Cassandra, but he'd found himself playing that role, seen as an alarmist while his warnings were ignored. Jeff dragged his thoughts back to the present. Though my primary concern was cybersecurity, I knew the internet could be used to organize and coordinate terrorist attacks, he told Sue, taking up where he'd left off. I wore out my welcome arguing for resources. I finally decided that only a seriously mounted terrorist attack against us with significant damage against a target that mattered was going to shake the lethargy of the intelligence community. I guess we got that on 9/11, didn't we? Jeff seemed to wince, and for a moment Sue feared she'd misspoken. After a pause, he said, "You'd think so, but I'm still not sure they got the point." Sue freshened their coffee and pushed the container of skim milk closer to Jeff. "Come on," she encouraged. Jeff prepared his coffee as he continued. In those days, I spent a lot of nights trolling hacker chat rooms looking for signs of a plot. Not much of a social life. Jeff smiled. No, probably about as active as yours. I might surprise you. She pointed her raised cup toward him. But finish the story. I'm waiting for the part about bosses not listening. Jeff looked away. How much did he really want to say? He'd avoided the subject until now. but maybe it would be good to talk about it. First, he told her how for most of 2001 he and his team, when available, worked to retrieve information from the hard drive disks sent to him, seized from various terrorists or terrorist suspects by a wide range of agencies throughout the world. The disks, or copies of them, had ended up in the hands of the CIA. If British SAS captured an IRA suspect, the hard drive from his computer or its clone would at some point find its way to Jeff's desk. It was the same for the Mossad. Even the CIA's own meager foreign agent force produced disks from time to time. As is generally the case in intelligence, the individual bits of data he produced from these sources by themselves meant little. Once he plucked them from the disk, though, they were fed into a master program by his unit, where they might or might not assume their proper place in the database about the terrorist world. He never knew. In fact, he had no idea if anyone was routinely consulting the growing body of data his unit was compiling on various worldwide terror groups. "So what happened?" Sue asked. Jeff saw how eager she was and wondered for a moment how she'd react to the whole story. "I really can't go into it. Let's just say my boss and I had a disagreement and I left." "There's a story there you'll have to trust me with sometime," she said mischievously. "Is that when you started your own company?" "Yes," Jeff said, glad to change the subject. "Turns out all those contacts I made with the company were good for something. It's been a bigger success than I ever expected, one job after another, so no complaints there." He sipped his coffee and turned to the problem at hand. "Let's get back to you. The bad news is that your records, financial as well as work product, are all but a total loss from what I can see. I keep holding out hope they'll turn up somewhere, but I don't think so. Is there anything you can do for us?" She looked hopeful, and he hated having to disappoint her. "I'm trying to identify the virus sufficiently so that we can be certain it's not in your nightly or weekly backup. With that information, we can determine if they're clean." He held up a hand of caution at seeing her become crestfallen. "I haven't found a hint of when you picked this up, so I can't tell from the time frame which, if any, of your backups are clean. It could have been lurking in there a very long time." Sue bit her lower lip. "I was afraid that might be the case." She thought a moment, then gave him a wan smile. "So, the worst-case scenario is that our current computers are fried. Useless. Whether or not we can recover the data from the backups, I'll still have to install a brand new system. It will kill me." She made a face at the very thought of it. "It's going to take weeks to physically put everything in place, then load and link the software, then at least a month to get all the bugs out. And we have to know how to find this virus before I can activate it with our old data so that someone doesn't inadvertently reintroduce it. I don't even want to think about that." She looked into his eyes. "Save me from it all, will you? I'll be very grateful." She drained her coffee, then yawned. "Have you noticed these marathon sessions are getting tougher and tougher the older you get?" "Give me a break, Sue. You're a kid compared to me." She smiled. "It's been good talking, though. If I get canned, I might come looking for a job." "It won't come to that, I'm sure," he said, though it wouldn't surprise him if she ended up being the scapegoat. It wouldn't be the first time he'd seen that happen. "I might come looking anyway." With that, she gave him a warm smile and left for the IT center, her short hair bouncing, lean hips swinging. Back at the office a little bit later, Jeff asked if she'd found anything useful. "Almost nothing," she grimaced. "I examined the logs. As I'm sure you know, we're hit thousands of times a day by malware looking for a vulnerability. Some of it's generated by a living hacker, but most are by automated worms trolling the internet. It was a bit daunting, realizing how under assault we constantly are, but I didn't see any failure in our protection. This obviously got through, but I can't see when or how. Wish I could be more help." "And Harold?" "I've had him re-imaging the lawyer workstations and laptop systems in the office with clean system installs of the operating system and necessary applications. He's also checking the email archives and database for signs of tampering." She yawned, covering her mouth with the back of a hand. "Last but not least, I've got him screening all the complaint calls we're getting from associates. They don't pay me enough to do that." She hesitated, as if considering something, then said, "I've been meaning to mention a string I came across in your printouts, but you are awfully busy. I don't think it's anything important, but look at this." Jeff leaned over and read, SH3WXR NN3VR13TUR SP!RXTZ D0WN SH3S A V RYK!RG!R7. Jeff realized he'd missed the text in his earlier scan. Sometimes the clues to a cracker were in the ego parts, those sections of code about himself he couldn't resist inserting. I never saw that. What is it? Don't laugh, but I think it's leet-speak, she said, straightening up. Leet-speak was hacker language. Malware authors often left their calling cards in their code, even if it was only for them and other hackers to see. Since this one was originally encrypted, it was obviously not meant for the eyes of security investigators. It's Super Freak, Sue said, dropping her arms. Super Freak, the song? I think so, Sue wrinkled her brow. How does it go? She's a very kinky girl, the kind you don't take home to mother, huh? Sue's singing voice was surprisingly deep and guttural. Now that she had the words and the tune, she was really getting into the song, swinging her hips, raising her voice. Yeah, I've still got it. Our hacker likes Rick James punk funk. He's not all bad. Aren't you a bit young to know Rick James? Super Freak was what, sometime in the early 80s? Rick James is classic. Jeff looked back at the screen. Okay, Super Freak. But what does it mean? Is that the name of the virus or the cracker's handle? Someone who is a Rick James fan? Super Freak might be significant, then again it might not, Jeff thought. Some virus code changed hands so many times, all kinds of leet-speak from script kiddies crept in. It might not be connected to the virus's author at all. It might be his cyber handle, Sue suggested. You should be looking for it in any code you find. I'll see if I can turn anything up in hacker chat rooms later. She yawned again. I'm beat. She gave him a winning smile. I'm going to lie down for a bit. I haven't pulled an all-nighter since college. She turned and walked away toward the couch, stretching as she did. No problem, Jeff murmured. I'll probably lie down a bit later myself. I've still got some juice, though, and will feel better if I can get something definite before taking a real break. Your boss will ask, I'm certain. He looked over at Sue. She was already asleep. Chapter 10 Brooklyn, New York. Mercy Hospital. Tuesday, August 15th. 8:09 a.m. Daryl Haugen was given full access to the IT center in the basement of Mercy Hospital, where she found the staff cooperative. They'd taken the deaths of patients personally. Winfield had dropped by several times, but she had nothing to give him. Working not far from a furnace at an unused station, it had taken nearly a day of work to unlock the code she detected in the server. Yet, so far she'd turned up nothing useful. She felt the adrenaline coursing through her despite the long hours. These crackers were so full of themselves, so certain they could fool everything. She went after them with a vengeance. She'd never been able to tolerate such self-satisfaction. She found it interesting that George Carlton, officially the man responsible for stopping this sort of thing, was no less egocentric. For some time, she thought he was just pitching his department when he crowed about his accomplishments. But she'd come to realize he actually believed he was doing an effective job. Contempt scarcely described her true feelings toward him. Something had scrambled the hospital medication program. She just couldn't identify it. Her staff in Virginia was on this, but thus far they'd come up with nothing useful. The more people of talent and skill she had engaged, the sooner they'd have a solution. So she'd been glad Jeff Aiken was available. He was bright, creative, and hard-working. From her experience, she knew he had the knack of thinking outside the box. Daryl had located suspect code from a corrupted registry file and was now running it through a string analyzer, a program that dumped any data values in the file that could be represented with a printable character. Many code values translated to printable characters, so there was a lot of garbage. But she also saw strings the programmer had in the code that referenced registry settings and files. programmers often left debugging code that included messages in place that would be revealed in the string output. It took Daryl a few minutes to go over the strings, which largely looked like this. RX plus percent quotes backslash. LEP. Bracket CCC. OAAAA underline EP. LRI question mark 9 backslash. Z underline forward slash VK less than hyphen. XRG question question question. M988M. 4 TTTTTAWK hyphen. 999877766MV period, comma, OA, each, U, TTTU, HRU, 8877666, period, comma, 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 ampersand, 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 1TU, YRIPPPF, M backslash, period, 1, comma, 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 2, TW, PPP, F-F-E-E-D-D. As she scanned the text, Daryl spotted a few strings that vaguely resembled words but weren't quite English. One grabbed her attention because it looked as if it contained the com, C-O-M, the domain of most internet sites, A-B-K com. But it was missing a separating dot between the A-B-K and com that would show up if the string were actually a universal resource locator, or URL, such as abk.com. Had the programmer left out the period for some reason? Perhaps it was a mistake or an attempt to hide that it was a URL. Trying to find clues and vaguely feeling as if there was more to the snippet, she continued examining it, letting her mind take her where it would. Intuition struck. Picking up her pen, she wrote the letters backward in her notebook. M-O-C-K-B-A. Of course. That was Moscow written in Cyrillic. Moscow? Why would that be a string? She searched for other clues in the text around it, but found nothing. And why would a Russian hacker want to change the medication program in an American hospital? She shot out of her chair and began to pace. It made no sense. Of course, the hacker could have copied code originally written by a Russian, but if it was Russian, the purpose of the virus should have been financial, since that's what most Russian malware was about. Unless this was something else. Daryl had been a child prodigy, smart as a whip from the first. Her parents, both professors at Stanford University, had encouraged her wide-ranging interests from the time she was a toddler. As their only child, she'd received undivided love and attention. So easily had things come to her, the child Daryl had been surprised to realize how slow her classmates were, even in the accelerated classes she attended. As she moved into her preteens, she finally found her place at a prestigious academy. Under the tutelage of a teacher from Spain, she discovered a natural affinity for language. Before she was 12 years old, she spoke Spanish, Portuguese, and Italian fluently. The transition into Latin and French in her teens was seamless. For a time, her parents were convinced she would become a linguist, and they accepted that as her natural vocation. But Daryl also enjoyed mathematics and computers. As each drew her increasing interest, she found herself more and more in the world of boys. When she began to blossom at age 15, even the geeks with whom she spent most of her days noticed, though they were too awkward and shy to do anything, a situation she thought was just as well. The last thing she wanted was a collection of panting admirers getting in the way of her real loves, numbers and the computer. Daryl had gone to MIT at 17. Then done her PhD work at Stanford while living with her parents. That had been nice, seeing them as adults, as equals. She'd come to appreciate the remarkable upbringing they'd given her. As she neared completion of her graduate work, Daryl had considered what to do. She'd always wanted to get the bad guys, and briefly considered applying to the FBI. In the end, she went with the National Security Agency, which had a greater use for her particular skills. The NSA intercepted foreign communications to develop intelligence information and relied extensively on computers to make it all happen. Daryl had always been most comfortable working alone, though consulting with Jeff Aiken had come naturally. In recent years, she'd stayed in routine business contact with him, especially when working on a new virus. They had met at Langley in the old CIA, the company, before the 9/11 fiasco and the creation of Homeland Security, back in the days when the CIA thought it knew everything. She'd been sent from NSA as part of a show committee of cooperation. In fact, none of the American intelligence agencies cooperated significantly with one another. Not the FBI, DIA, NSA, or CIA. But they were routinely admonished to cooperate. So committees such as hers were created, and meetings such as the one where she'd met Jeff were held from time to time. "See if you can find anyone there," her boss had instructed, meaning see if she could connect with someone useful, willing to share information despite the unofficial policy against such cooperation. Jeff had been a new face, so she'd taken the open seat next to him, separated by the corner of the conference table. Jeff was a handsome man, one who took care of himself, she noticed, as she waited for the meeting to start. Not at all like most of the others in the room. He placed a mug of black coffee on the coaster before him, then said, "Could you hand me the sweetened low, please?" The bowl was to her left. She reached over and handed him a pink packet. The moment their fingers touched, an electric shock went through her body. His hand hesitated. She was certain he felt the same thing. She looked at his clear gray eyes. He glanced at hers, then looked away. Clumsily opening the sweetener, he poured it into the mug, spilling almost as much as he put in the coffee. "I'll need a napkin. I'm all thumbs today," he said without meeting her eye. During Daryl's junior year at MIT, when she was 19, she'd been heavily courted by the scion to one of America's wealthiest and oldest families. With a name embarrassingly long and followed with the number 4, he was considered the most desirable catch on campus. When her dorm sisters first realized that 4 was interested in their nerdy roommate, they'd been envious. Daryl had never before been courted, not like that, and found the experience interesting as a form of minor cultural ritual. 4 was pleasant when he wanted to be, but she'd told her mother, not really quite smart enough for MIT. She wondered why he'd come. "Because Dad wanted me to attend Yale," he told her one evening when she asked. "Anywhere, I like it here. Better since meeting you." That night they'd gone to bed for the first and only time. In his room, 4 had stopped her from undressing, telling her he wanted the privilege for himself. She'd stood unmoving as he slowly unbuttoned and unzipped her out of her winter clothing. She'd observed the experience as if it were occurring to someone else, as if she were standing to the side. When at last she was down to her bra and panties, 4 had pressed her to the bed, removed his clothes, then lay beside her. Then he slowly removed her bra and panties, breathing heavily as if lost in a trance. It was January, and from the uncovered window silver moonlight spread across her now nude body. 4 stopped as she lay naked and said over and over, "Magnificent, magnificent." The sex was better than she'd expected. Daryl could see why a woman might get excited over it. But afterward, 4 had been distant, as if wrapped in his own world. He called repeatedly after that night, but she'd never gone out with him again. She understood what was going on and was not flattered. Throughout their weeks of dating, 4 had repeatedly spoken of her beauty. Then he had worshipped at its altar. She had no desire to be any man's idol. From that night forward, she committed herself to her work. No more dating, no more pawing. She wore baggy clothes, no makeup, and buried herself in her studies. She counted herself the better for the experience. 4, she realized, had been full of himself, certain he was God's gift to women, to her, to the world, when in fact he was a self-satisfied, egocentric snob. She considered herself well rid of him, and from this had come her utter contempt for egocentrics. 4 had not taken rejection well. He spread stories that Daryl was a slut, that he dropped her because she'd cheated on him. His stories only seemed to increase the attention of the other male students, and no hiding beneath oversized clothes could conceal her obvious beauty and latent sexuality. As a release, and because she discovered her aptitude for sport, Daryl played intramural soccer after moving to Stanford for graduate work. She threw herself into the game and, if not the star of the team, was taken seriously as a player. On weekends, she backpacked and hiked throughout Northern California and parts of Nevada. She skied at every opportunity. When Daryl first met Jeff, she was working in cybersecurity, performing virus analysis, at that time a new field. A rising star in the NSA, she had played a major role in identifying the hackers of 2 high-profile viruses. Overall, though, she was bored and generally annoyed by the obvious attention of men to her physical appearance. She learned, however, that it could work to her advantage. As for marriage and family, she had her work and found it endlessly fascinating. After that first meeting, she'd seen Jeff at two others. Following the third, a small group had gone for coffee together. It devolved into just the two of them. Their conversation had been on the merits of the Windows operating system versus that of the Macintosh, and in such detail they'd driven the others away. Not once, she realized, had he looked at her breasts, and for the first time since they'd developed, she was disappointed. What was the point of great tits if a man who interested you didn't notice? Over the telephone, she'd once complained about it to her mom, a woman of considerable beauty herself. The ones you don't want to notice will. The ones you'd like to notice usually won't. Get used to it, she told her daughter. Daryl and Jeff had reached that point where young couples talk about themselves. She'd gone first. When it was Jeff's turn, he told her how he'd been raised by two elderly grandparents who had doted on him. It sounds lonely, she'd said. They were awfully good people and very loving. They passed before I graduated from college. I've been mostly on my own since, until recently, that is. He'd brightened, then told her about his girlfriend, Cynthia. That had been the end of any thoughts she'd had about the two of them. After that, they worked together from time to time. At one juncture, he'd provided her with significant information, unofficially. A few months later, she'd done the same. From then on, they'd formed a fast and close working relationship, unfettered by his relationship with Cynthia. She'd learned through a mutual friend of Cynthia's death, and had, in her subsequent contacts with Jeff, noticed the change in him. Where once he'd frequently been lighthearted, now he was somber. She regretted that she'd never found the proper moment to express her condolences at his loss. She was looking forward to seeing him, especially as she was convinced he was the one person who could help her with this virus. As for the rest, well, time would tell. Chapter 11. Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Rua Francisco Otaviano. Tuesday, August 15th, 10:16 a.m. With a touch of distaste, Maria Braga watched the scraggly-haired young man enter. The Euro Internet Cafe, just two blocks from Copacabana Beach in Rio, catered largely to the tourists who walked by and to certain cariocas who didn't have a computer of their own. She knew both types at a glance. The tourists were dressed in fresh beach attire, while the locals were primarily diligent, well-scrubbed students. With six computers and one booth for international telephone calls crammed into the long, narrow room, Maria made an adequate living for herself and her daughter. In the 4 years she'd run the cafe, she'd only been robbed once. The young man's name was Nicolau. Maria thought he was weird. She didn't like the way he looked at her, staring at her modestly covered breasts as if she were naked. She was certain he was some kind of pervert. And he was a nerd. She could tell this guy knew all about computers. He'd probably built his own at home, or at least bought the very latest models. From the looks of his expensive watch, he could afford it. He didn't have to use hers, so why did he? Nicolau rarely stayed at the station more than 3 or 4 minutes. That alone was strange. He was up to something, but she had no idea what. She thought about charging him more. Maybe he'd go somewhere else, but her fees were posted. 19-year-old Nicolau da Costa was a hacker. His father was a senior vice president with Banco Central do Brasil, while his mother ran a modest flower shop on Avenida Nossa Senhora de Copacabana. Nicolau spent his nights at his computer playing video games or online in various chat rooms, exchanging virus code, talking endlessly about creating a virus that everyone in the world would know, but wouldn't cause enough damage to get him arrested. He'd found it wasn't that easy. More than once he'd been on the verge of launching a virus, but it always held back. Brazilian prisons were notorious. He had nightmares about ending up in one. You never knew when the authorities might decide to make an example of someone. Even his father wouldn't be able to help. Every once in a while, though, a job came along. This was the fifth in less than a month. He dropped onto the chair and checked to confirm that the computer was connected to the Internet. He looked back at Maria up front, then slipped his floppy into the computer and launched the code. The email had told him to leave the floppy in place for 3 minutes. As he waited, he browsed 2 websites. Then, satisfied, extracted the floppy. Now he entered his Yahoo email account and sent the following message. Date, Tuesday, 15 August, 1021, 0700. He typed in the address, careful that no one was looking. From Riostud. Riostud69@yahoo.com. Subject, sent. Release code. Ready for another when you are. Send money. Riostud. At the counter, Nicolau smiled as he counted out the coins for his time. Nicolau thought Maria was hot, but wondered if she had been raised in a convent. He and his friends talked about traditional girls like that, though none of them had ever met one who had been. She sure dressed like a nun. Chapter 12. Manhattan, New York City, IT Center. Fisherman, Platt & Cohen. Tuesday, August 15, 10:25 a.m. Stepping outside the building, Jeff was surprised to see it was mid-morning. A slight breeze was coming in off the Atlantic, and the air was clear, invigorating after the sterility of the IT center. He walked around the corner to a deli he'd spotted earlier, where Daryl had agreed to meet him. He was looking forward to seeing her again. Quite apart from her ability to help him in his work, he'd always enjoyed her company. For the last day, the world outside had not existed for him. Nothing mattered but the pixels on the screen, accessing the operating system. The story he discovered, as he inched his way toward solving the problem, the bits of information that formed together in time to crack the mystery, and the final recovery of the blocked, stolen, or destroyed data. Though this one was not solved, not yet. Daryl was due any minute. As he entered, he realized that the deli might have been out of Seinfeld, with a dozen people ensconced in booths or sitting on stools. He took an end booth, placed an order for coffee, then sat drinking as he waited. He felt bad about leaving Sue with such a mess, but he had to take a break and rest to think clearly. He glanced over at 2 men and 1 woman working on laptops with Wi-Fi and wondered how many viruses each had without knowing it. 2 other men in business suits were sitting at a small table having an animated conversation. From the few words he picked up, they were talking baseball. Apparently, the Yankees were losing. As a barista cleared a table beside him, Daryl Haugen entered, glancing first left, then right. She was wearing her usual garb of jeans with a tight white blouse. He waved a hand, she spotted him, smiled warmly, and came over. Sitting across from him, she placed a half-empty bottle of water on the table, then flopped her laptop bag onto the floor. She looked stressed, very, very tired, and lovely. There was no denying her beauty. He once sat in a meeting, bored out of his mind, only to realize he'd been staring at her. Her returning look had not been pleasant, and he'd been careful ever since. Still, simply being with her was an appealing experience. For an instant, he couldn't help comparing her to Sue. Daryl had a freshness, a spontaneous way of behaving about her that was quite engaging. Sue was more artifice and calculation. The 2 women could not have been more different, and his response to each was night and day. He felt relaxed and open around Daryl, but on guard with Sue, making sure that he kept within the bounds of professional interaction. "No coffee?" he asked. She shook her head. "No, I had plenty earlier. It gets me wired if I'm not careful. How've you been? How's it going in the cold, cold world of private enterprise?" In the years since he'd left the CIA, the 2 had run into each other at the occasional conference, but mostly they'd exchanged emails and talked over the phone about difficult problems they'd encountered. Jeff was by nature a puzzle solver, while Daryl was the most gifted computer expert he'd ever encountered. Together they made a great team, but their different lines of work didn't offer many opportunities for collaboration. "I'm doing fine," he said. "Business continues to boom. I do it all myself so I don't have to waste time with employees. It keeps me busy. My main problem is reminding myself to keep increasing my fees. Computer security is a pretty hot topic for many companies. But who am I telling? How do you like CERT?" "It's U.S. CERT, and I like it a lot." She grinned, and for a moment the tension in her face vanished. In the wake of 9/11 came recognition that cyberspace was vulnerable to attack and that something needed to be done. The new Department of Homeland Security lumped together a number of previously independent and disparate groups in various agencies. Related to that, but also independent of it, in early 2003, the president issued a directive creating the National Cyberspace Security Response System, and within it, the United States Computer Emergency Readiness Team, labeled in government jargon USCERT. As the operational arm of the National Cybersecurity Division, its primary objective was to create a strategic framework to prevent cyber attacks against U.S. computer-oriented infrastructure. A different organization known as CERT had been created earlier, in response to the infamous Morris worm, which had brought 10% of Internet systems to a halt in 1988. Housed at and part of the Development Center at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, it held a less audacious mandate. CERT was intended to coordinate communication among the various cyber experts to prevent future virus outbreaks, though with the advent of 9/11, the older CERT's profile had significantly increased. But the total effect of so many organizations with overlapping jurisdictions hadn't improved America's defenses. Instead, it created chaos. Turf wars intensified rather than easing, and obvious measures took months or years of discussion and debate to implement, if at all, because it wasn't clear which organization was ultimately accountable. In Jeff's view, it was all tragic and pointless. The threat was self-evident. Only those with the power to do something about it seemed unaware. How anyone could do nothing in the face of such an obvious threat was something he could never comprehend or accept. The anger he felt whenever he thought of it burned at him. But he could do nothing more than what he'd already done and continued to do. Every workday. Sometimes he wanted to scream, but he knew no one would listen. He'd just be defined as a kook, and in consequence, lose any effectiveness he had. This was, he now realized, one more reason why he'd made a point to stay in contact with Daryl. "I didn't know you were a field operative," Jeff said. She gave him a quirky smile. "I have a very competent team. Between my laptop, email, and cell phone, we're in constant contact," she paused, "and I needed to see this situation for myself." "How do you like Homeland Security?" he asked with a knowing smile. Daryl grimaced. "The bureaucracy can be wearing, but my part's pretty good and getting better. I'm surprised anyone's got time to work." "You with my old friend George?" "With? We consult one another. I don't spend any more time with him than I need to." "How's that going?" he asked, though he had no doubt of the answer. She despised the man as much as he did. "Did I mention bureaucracy?" She made a face. "Don't get me going, though honestly, when it comes to that group and their maneuvering for power, he's better than some I could name. It's just that I feel like I'm talking into an empty oil drum most of the time. All I hear is my own echo back. Commercial attacks are up steeply, but both he and the department don't really seem to care about that all that much. Lots of people and companies are losing information that costs them money. These high-tech crime groups in Russia are getting fat off of us, and nobody's made them a priority. I hear the company ran another simulated attack last summer." Such information was common knowledge in the elite world of cybersecurity Jeff occupied. He'd been waiting to ask someone in the know about it. "What was the outcome?" She laughed. "It was like all the ones before Silent Horizon in 2005, or Operation Cyberstorms 1... 2 in 2006, and then Cyberstorm 3 in 2009. CIA and DHS rigged the tests so completely, there was no way they couldn't defend. They established perimeters no real attacker would ever follow, while everyone defending a system against penetration knew the attack was coming and what the rules of the game were. It was ludicrous, but management took great comfort from the results. They're back to worrying about terrorists blowing up a computer system. It's like the old FBI chasing bank robbers while the mafia was running rampant. DHS does what its component parts have always done. There's an extraordinary lack of imagination there." Daryl shook her head, still amazed at the stupidity of it all. "It's got, what, more than 200,000 employees? That's enough manpower to do the job right." "That's it," Daryl confirmed. "Cybersecurity is so far down the totem pole we hardly count. If it wasn't for the work of the private computer and internet security companies, we'd be getting nowhere." She took a pull of water. "Did you read about the airplane?" Jeff shook his head. "I've been in a cocoon. What happened?" "As I understand it, a British Airways flight from London to New York had an incident over the Atlantic." "Don't tell me it was a Boeing 787. Jeff had long anticipated such an event, given its heavy dependence on computers.
Yes, indeed. A fly-by-wire computer-designed and operated aircraft.
What happened?
Apparently the plane began to climb very slowly, and the airspeed dropped while on autopilot. The crew was not alerted and didn't recognize their danger until it was nearly too late. As it was, the plane stalled at 40,000 feet.
Jesus!
Jeff shook his head in disbelief. Like the Spanair crash last year, they think that was caused by malware.
Yes.
They were lucky they were so high. They needed all but a couple thousand of those feet to recover.
What happened?
We don't know. But I understand they were only able to save the airplane by rebooting the controlling computer in flight.
That took nerve.
Jeff was impressed. Someone had known what to do when the chips were down and had acted on that knowledge.
More than you can imagine. They had no command while the computer was offline. There is no mechanical backup to the controls. That plane fell like a rock.
Jeff gave a low whistle.
That's a bright crew to manage something like that under those conditions.
Darrell raised an eyebrow.
They deserve a medal.
But you haven't heard the best part. When they tried to reboot, the computer locked up. They had to power off. It's a miracle they got enough control back in time.
My God, Jeff thought.
He couldn't imagine anyone having the presence of mind to pull off a stunt like that in such an emergency. Those men really did deserve a medal. Still, those systems should have been secure from infection, and fail-safes should have prevented the need for manual intervention.
What about the redundant systems?
They didn't work.
She paused.
There were 8 deaths. They managed to pull out of the dive that followed the stall, but the plane shot up to over 50,000 feet before nosing down again. The autopilot was handling the roller coaster ride, but still. No one in back was prepared, and most were unbuckled. Passengers were knocked around like pieces of cordwood. 5 of the deaths were small children. They were thrown around like missiles. The adult deaths were from broken necks and internal injuries. 1 passenger is paralyzed. Many others were seriously injured.
Welcome to the 21st century.
Jeff ran his hand through his hair, then picked up his coffee.
Cold.
Darrell nodded.
So, tell me what you found.
Jeff filled her in on what he knew so far. U.S. CERT worked cooperatively with the Cyber Security Industry Alliance, formed by Symantec and McAfee, among others, as well as with the Internet Security Departments of every major corporation and computer and software giants such as IBM's Internet Security Systems and Microsoft. It was in everyone's interest to cooperate. That was one reason she'd been willing to meet him when he told her he'd run across something unusual. As he spoke, she nodded, taking an occasional sip of water. When he told her about the words to the song Super Freak, though, she put her water bottle down.
I just ran into that same name this morning at Mercy Hospital, she said when he stopped.
It was spelled S-U-P-E-R-P-H-R-E-A-K. It was as if a piece of an especially difficult puzzle had fallen into place.
I haven't seen the name under any spelling, just the disguised word from the song Super Freak.
I was at Mercy when you called, she said, talking more rapidly. But they didn't lose some billing or litigation records. Like I told you, 4 patients were killed. The program modified their medicine records and instruction.
Jeff, I think we're investigating the same virus.
Did you hear about the death at a Ford assembly plant?
He shook his head.
I can't be certain, but it appears the plant's robot software picked up a virus that sat there waiting. The virus took over without warning, causing the robots to perform in non-scripted ways. We think that's when the worker was knocked onto the assembly line railing. In response, the company powered down and unplugged the robots. Their server was fried. They installed a replacement and are reloading the software. It looks like they'd be all right except for the death, of course, and the loss of about 2 weeks' production. The financial cost to them will be in the tens of millions.
Jeff was puzzled.
I thought industry networks were offline for security purposes.
They mostly are, and this one was.
I talked to the IT manager again this morning. They traced the original virus to a software engineer's laptop. He was in the habit of downloading whatever he was working on, then taking it home with him. He picked up the virus there when he used the same laptop to access the Internet. When he hooked it up at work, the worm latched onto the company's software, planting the virus.
Jeff thought a moment, then said,
back to the 787 incident. Is it possible what we're dealing with could be crafted for avionics software?
I don't know, she said, looking surprised at the thought.
It seems unlikely,
but it highlights one of the problems we're having. We don't know what the virus is doing and what it isn't doing. For that matter, there could very well be any number of incidents about which we know nothing. The world is so computer-dependent, you can't always make the connection to one of the viruses when something happens. So what's Super Freak? Do you have any idea? Not yet. I've got my team working on it. It could be almost anything. It could be a word left by a script kiddie. It could even be the cracker's name. Daryl pushed away her water bottle and started drumming her fingers on the table. It looks to me as if whoever wrote this used old code, copied and pasted to create this one. I don't think he realized the word was there. I found parts of Super Freak in three places. I think he's Russian, Jeff speculated. I can't put my finger on it, but the way some of the code is written just has that look. And given their track record, this could well be an economic attack of some kind by the Russians. Daryl stared at Jeff, impressed. Good guess, Mr. Holmes. I found the word Moscow written in Cyrillic in the code not long before I ran into Super Freak. So that's it, then. Jeff experienced a moment of elation. Russians. Just as he thought. It felt good to have been right. Do you have any idea how widespread this is? He wasn't in a position to know, but Daryl was. When I left for the office Monday, we had 7 reports that looked suspicious. We've picked up more than 50 since then. Jeff was astounded. It's spreading pretty fast. Who's working on detection and a fix? I think I can safely say none of the private security companies are at this point, though they've been alerted, and we've given them all the code we have. They report a higher-than-usual flood of former viruses and variants that require their attention. Super Freak hasn't appeared in any of their honeypots, and we can't prove a connection, so they think we're overreacting. It's very frustrating. We're assuming we won't be able to figure out the vulnerabilities these things use to spread right away, or get the software companies responsible for them to release fixes anytime soon. So we were hoping to get them onto the problem immediately, but no luck. Daryl shrugged. But even if they did respond, the problem is, as you know, that it would take weeks to come up with signatures and patches. And that's the best case. How long it takes for users to download and install them is another matter altogether. You should push the process, Jeff said. You can't just leave it to agency inertia. He could have bit his tongue. He knew Daryl was doing everything she could. I'm trying. She looked annoyed. Why so pessimistic? Daryl glanced around the room, then leaned forward. When she spoke, her voice was subdued but firm. Because so far we've spotted at least 10 variations of the code, and we aren't talking knockoffs. These were written with entirely different code, as if by a different cracker. But in the end, they all do something very destructive. I have no idea how many variations there are, and not knowing gives me the willies. Jeff thought of the airliner falling out of the sky, the hospital deaths, the man killed on the assembly line. Were these just the tip of the iceberg? Mentally, he ran through a list of other dangers. Nuclear power stations, traffic control systems, defense networks, Wall Street. The list was limitless, and suddenly he felt overwhelmed. What else? It seems to be composed of 3 functions. The first is the exploit code that gets the virus into the system without detection. The second is the trigger. The third is the payload itself, which causes all the damage. We've got 3 variants of the exploit, 5 of the virus, and we've just started. I've no idea how many others there are. She sighed. 2 hospitals outside of New York report their medicine distribution systems were also jumbled. We know of 11 deaths nationally so far. A small power station in Connecticut had its sluice gate turned wide open, and it couldn't be closed. By the time they figured out the problem was the computer they used to control their water release and the electricity they produce, they'd lost a significant amount of reserve capacity. It will take them 2 years to restore it. They didn't have backup software and are running manually now. It's almost laughable, but they had to recall a retired worker to show them how the system works without a computer. A nuclear power plant in Iowa had to do a mechanical shutdown to prevent a meltdown. This next one's been kept out of the news so far, but Tucson International Airport lost its air traffic control system. Fortunately, it was during a slow period, and there were no incidents. More and more is coming in every hour, but you can see why I'm not sleeping well. Until now, Jeff realized, he'd been focused on his client's narrow problem. He'd not seen it as part of an expanding and dangerous reality. Daryl was scaring the hell out of him. and he experienced a surge of anxiety and fear he'd not felt since those last days before 9/11. What's the potential? She paused, then said, Anything's possible. It looks as if we're just seeing the surface. Here's what's frightening me. Jeff felt another chill shoot through his body. If Daryl was frightened, then this was even bigger than he feared. First, we can't detect the virus coming in, and that's going to be a tough egg to crack. We've got to get the signatures written, the patches prepared, then out there, and I don't think there's enough time. Second, a single signature isn't going to work. The variants are too different. Jeff nodded, took a sip of coffee, then explained what he'd learned, and what he didn't yet know. When he finished, Daryl groaned, This super freak, if that's the cracker's cyber handle, could be Chechen, or he could be a gun for hire and working for almost anyone. The Russian mob, to name just one. Neither of them said anything for several minutes as they absorbed what they had learned. I've got more, she finally said. There are other propagation methods besides or in addition to the worms. My team is reporting they found 3 of the variants that spread through the address book of each computer they touched, and several of the ones we've looked at are polymorphic or metamorphic, so they look different each time they replicate. That's what I was getting at before. One I found wanted to replicate, Jeff confirmed. The system went down so fast I doubt any of it got out, but that was its intention. What if every variant is self-replicating? Jeff sat back in his chair. I hate to bring up more bad news, but have you considered this? Whoever is spreading this virus might still be at it. They could be sending new variants out every day. I'm sorry to add to your misery, but you need to get certain DHS serious about this. Daryl threw up her hands. I'm only one person with a small team. We've had 6 directors heading up DHS cybersecurity since it was created. Almost none of them have lasted so much as a year, most only a few months. They have no clout in DHS, and if they're in the driver's seat when the attack comes, it could end their career. This is all very familiar, isn't it? Jeff asked. He'd worked long enough in the government system to know what she was up against. I'm afraid so. Daryl's beautiful face was creased with worry. We're trying to get the industry interested. But we're way behind the curve on this. We have no idea how many variants there are or how many others are coming out. I lay awake last night imagining the harm that will come if we're only seeing a small portion of the super freak viruses. Take it easy. We're probably over-evaluating, and it's not as bad as we fear. Daryl wasn't buying it. Look at the body count already. Super freak, if that's what's causing this, is already the most deadly virus ever unleashed, and it's just starting. That's why I'm in Manhattan. There are dead people here because of this thing. We have no idea the long-term harm Super Freak can cause. She paused, then leaned across the table, her blonde hair falling forward. Let me tell you what I think. What we need to do is stop this at the source. How? Despite himself, Jeff knew she was right. He'd had the same thought late the night before, but hadn't wanted to admit it until she'd said it aloud. Find the cracker in his home. Get distribution stopped at the wellspring, then learn from him or his computers exactly how many variants there are. If we had that information, I could rush through the fix and the antivirus changes, and we could stop this thing in its tracks. Jeff smiled. You have a black ops team that does that? Hell no, Daryl said grimly. We sure as hell need one. Chapter 13. Lower Manhattan, New York City. World Trade Center site, Tuesday, August 15, 11:47 a.m. Exhausted as he was, Jeff wanted nothing so much as to go straight to his hotel room. But there was no denying this. It had to be done. 2 blocks to the west, he located a subway, bought a Metro card, then rode the train downtown. The car was clean, cleaner than he recalled from his summer of weekend trips here that ill-fated year. For 2 years, Jeff had been in a serious relationship with Cynthia Wheel. They lived in the same complex just outside Richmond, Virginia, and had met at the gym they shared. Petite with raven hair, she'd been a vivacious and bright young woman. It had been easy to settle into the life of an old married couple with her, without ever actually doing the deed, as she was fond of saying, especially when naked and about to suggest another bout of sexual play. Jeff felt a real sense of loss when, in May of 2001, Cynthia's company, ARM, account resources management of Richmond, Virginia, had transferred her to Manhattan. Jeff helped her pack, then drove her to her new apartment. "We won't let this be the end of us," she assured him just as he prepared to leave. "I promise." She'd kissed him sweetly on the mouth, stepped back, flashed her winning smile, and said, "Wish me luck." In the months that followed, his routine was consistent. He began recording the long hours he normally gave the CIA gratis, and left the office at 1 p.m. every Friday to take the shuttle flight to New York City. After spending the weekend with Cynthia, he'd return home late Sunday. In August, she'd flown to see him twice, complaining of the sweltering heat in Manhattan, but by September she was thrilled as the days turned cooler with the prospect of autumn. That August, Jeff had received a disc originally seized from the ruling Taliban by one of the rival Afghan groups. He'd cracked into the disc within minutes of receiving it and saw at once that, despite its provenance, it was not Taliban. It had been prepared by a group called Al-Qaeda, the base. Dredging up a vague memory of Al-Qaeda, Jeff remembered it was one of a number of terrorist groups on the radar screen of the company, though it held no significance to him. He checked the terrorist database, to which he routinely contributed, and was brought up cold. Led by an enormously rich and shadowy figure, Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda might not be the biggest or best-known terrorist group, but it tended to target Americans with deadly results. For the next 3 days, Jeff gleaned information from the disc and carefully analyzed its contents, a role beyond his purview. Checking the master database several times, he found a dozen recent entries that seemed connected. Next, he drafted a timeline. On one side of the program, he listed information by date to analyze the data flow. On the other, he listed events in the order they were to occur. He could scarcely believe what he was seeing. He printed the program, sketched an analysis, then buzzed his boss's secretary and asked for a meeting as soon as possible. For the next 2 hours, Jeff reviewed his information, tearing it apart as a critic might. The stark facts remained. Only an idiot, someone too blind to see the obvious, could fail to see what he'd uncovered. With dismay, he realized that was a good description of his boss. George Carlton was a burly man of average height, turned soft by 2 decades in government bureaucracy. His sallow skin had become excessively sensitive to daylight over the years, and he now burned quite easily. When he came into the office after a weekend in the country or at sea, his face would shine a bright red. Carlton had begun his career as an FBI desk agent, moving into middle management from there. Then, for reasons never fully explained, he took a position with the CIA as manager of the Cyber Terrorism Computer Forensics Department. The move was unusual, but on paper at least it seemed a good fit. At that time, computers and their use for terrorism was not a high priority, since there'd been no documented case of a foreign terrorist act within the continental United States, either against the supporting computers of the Internet or by using its resources. With the additions of other functions, including the Computer Science Group and its obscure cyber terrorism unit, Carlton's areas of power and presumed expertise steadily grew. He was a born bureaucrat, adept at evading responsibility for errors while garnering praise for work he'd not performed. He made few enemies over the years, which served him well. But the lack of attention his department received was the greatest boon to his career. Prior to 2001, little was expected of him in the twilight world of counterterrorism in which he'd found a niche. Though he would have preferred an airy corner office on the second or third floor, he was content with his location, far from any window and deep within the center of the ground floor. Shortly after 4 o'clock that afternoon, Jeff was ushered in, carrying with him the proof he hoped his supervisor would find persuasive. Carlton didn't rise as he gestured for Jeff to take a seat in front of his desk. "What have you got?" A bad boss is typically characterized as hostile, rude, and dim. Carlton was never, or at least rarely, rude. He'd been in government service too many years to be overtly hostile, and he was not stupid. For the next 10 minutes, Jeff laid out what he believed was going to take place on September 11, less than 2 weeks away. Carlton listened with diminishing enthusiasm, then asked to see the timeline. He spent a full minute examining it before commenting, "I'm confused about something. Just where do these supposed targets come from? The Statue of Liberty, the Pentagon, the World Trade Center, the White House, the Capitol, the Sears Tower, The Golden Gate Bridge, the Washington Monument. He looked up. Mount Rushmore? I suppose I can see the logic of the Pentagon, the other government buildings even, but Mount Rushmore? I don't get it. I admit listing all of them as possible targets is speculative, but it's speculation based on text, Jeff said. Those names came from various communiques. They're not only after what could be called hard targets, structures connected to our government and military, but also after our economic infrastructure and landmarks. Jeff's mouth was dry, and he found the words difficult to form. They're very into symbolism, and Al-Qaeda's targeted the World Trade Center previously. Their purpose with those truck explosives was to topple one of the buildings into the other, taking them both down like dominoes. Carlton snickered. They were wrong, weren't they? In fact, Al-Qaeda isn't all that effective, if you look at their track record, and they certainly seem to prefer the Horn of Africa. It's difficult to see them posing a genuine threat to us from, where are they? Afghanistan, of all places? It's all there, Jeff insisted, pointing at the documents he'd assembled. Most of it, at least, enough. Though he was struggling to contain himself, his voice rose a bit as he said, "We need to do something." Carlton looked at him sharply. "Have you any idea how many threats a day are processed by the company? Each one is given a score. If I pass this one higher up, it will receive, I'm telling you categorically, the lowest priority score that exists." Jeff's heart sank. "You can't just sit on it," he said in near desperation. Carlton paused. "I'm not gonna sit on it, as you put it. But we need more information or no one will act. I'm gonna hold on to this for a few days. Don't be concerned. There's plenty of time yet. In the meanwhile, see if you can get me something with meat on the bones. But be assured that either way, I'll pass it along in time." Driven by a mix of frustration and fear, Jeff skipped his trip to New York City that weekend, and the one after, each time telling Cynthia that as much as he wanted to see her, he was buried by a pile of work and wouldn't be able to relax even if he did come. With a passion born of desperation, he worked 18 hours a day, every day, pulling his two assistants from their IT assignments and instilling in them his own sense of urgency as he put them to work on the project. Accessing real-time chat rooms and other sources previously identified as Al-Qaeda communication channels, what emerged was a terrorist plan on the fast track. Collecting intelligence wasn't his job and shouldn't be necessary. What he'd already done should have unleashed the enormous resources of the company. By Tuesday, September 4, after preparing a far more comprehensive presentation of what he considered to be a highly credible threat to America, Jeff went directly to Carlton's secretary. "This is urgent. Will you see to it George gets this at once? He's expecting it." She'd smiled stiffly and taken the file. He didn't like leaving it that way, but given the nature of his relationship with his boss and the bureaucracy of the company, his hands were tied. It wasn't how he wanted to handle it. It was how he had to handle it, if he wanted anything positive to happen. Back in his office, Jeff continued with his relentless schedule, sleeping on his couch, washing up and shaving in the restroom. Carlton emailed him that he'd forwarded the file to the appropriate teams, but despite his effort and long hours, nothing more of consequence emerged. Beside himself with anger and frustration, he called Cynthia in Manhattan on Friday, September 7. ARM's offices were at the World Financial Center just across the street from the World Trade Center. "I need you to do something for me without my going into detail," he said, knowing Cynthia would instantly grasp the time for questions was later. "I want you not to go into work next week. Stay home, or better yet, leave the city." The target date might get moved a day or two, so he didn't specify Tuesday. "Can you work from home, or better yet, visit your folks?" "Wow, pretty short notice." Her voice was steady, and he felt reassured she'd do as he asked. "It's not just important. It's vital." "Vital, huh?" From the beginning, Cynthia had been impressed with Jeff's serious and sober nature. Only when she finally grasped the full extent of it had she seriously begun to consider him for a husband. Her confidence in him and his judgment had continued to grow as they dated. "As in life and death?" "You could say that." Jeff fought off the sudden urge to tell her everything. He'd kept it inside for so long he was about to burst. But he couldn't. He just couldn't. It wasn't so much that he was worried that he was wrong, but scared of the panic he could set off. She had to act on his warning, and he was considering what he'd do next if she didn't. But his serious answer seemed to sober her. "Okay, I'll visit my folks. Won't they be surprised?" Jeff breathed a sigh of relief. "Thank you, thank you. Make it all week, please. I want your promise that you're leaving the city tomorrow morning, and no matter what, you won't go to work next week." "Okay, I promise. Cross my heart, hope to die." Cynthia was perplexed by the entire exchange. Was there a threat he couldn't mention? Clearly that was his message. It couldn't have been at her personally, or he'd have said so. Given what he did for a living, that meant it was a terrorist attack. Jeff was in a position to know about such things, and she also knew, from what little he'd told her over their time together, that most threats came to nothing. She had confidence in her country. Jeff was just being cautious, and she loved him all the more for it. The worst part was, she could say nothing to her co-workers, not without getting Jeff fired or even indicted. Jeff was a sober man, not given to extremes. If he told her that she needed to leave town, she was prepared to take his word for it. She considered her alternatives, none were appealing. She wasn't about to drive to Albany and check into a motel for the week. Still, she'd promised, and a promise made was one to be kept. She decided to work from her home all week, and arranged to have what she needed brought to her, claiming she was deathly ill and highly contagious. Shortly after speaking with her, Jeff made a mental note to call Cynthia on Sunday, then attempted to meet with Carlton again, but was told he had no opening until the following week. Frantically, Jeff took to prowling the hallways near Carlton's office and intercepted him on his way to a meeting. "Do you have any word yet on my report?" Jeff asked, keeping pace with his superior. "Yes," Carlton said, giving him a pointed look. "They're giving it due consideration. There's more information that seems to nail next Tuesday down as a date and confirms a number of the targets, including the Capitol, the White House, and the Pentagon." "I told you, I passed it along." Carlton all but rolled his eyes. "Now I've got a meeting, Jeff. It's been taken care of. Move on. You know these Arabs. They couldn't organize a conga line." With that, Carlton ducked into a conference room. Jeff knew it was pointless going over Carlton's head, but he tried anyway. He knew he was making enemies, understood that he was effectively ending his government career, but he didn't care. This was too important. When everyone of consequence had gone home on Friday, he was left with nothing else to do but continue working throughout the weekend and into Monday with his team. Following a 36-hour stretch, vainly searching for another bit of concrete proof, totally consumed by his work, Jeff lost track of time and never called Cynthia. And so it went uneventfully all day Monday, when, out of the blue, one of Cynthia's college roommates called and suggested breakfast at Windows on the World at the World Trade Center the next morning. She knew Cynthia was about to become engaged and wanted to hear all the details. Cynthia left her apartment that morning to meet her, excited at the prospect of sharing her private hopes and dreams with the woman who had once been her best friend. In Langley, Jeff was distracted by his cell phone, which rang, rang, rang. Digging around in his clothing, he pressed a button. "Something terrible's happened." Cynthia's voice was strained as if she was about to cry. "I stayed home like I promised. I did. Then Karen came to town, and we went to breakfast, then... In the background, Jeff could hear pandemonium. "Where are you?" "Windows on the World. The restaurant at the top of one of the towers." For a moment, Jeff heard and felt nothing. His body turned numb. When her voice returned, it was from far away. "Felt something a little bit ago. The whole building just shuddered, and I thought we were going to fall over." Her voice was quivering. He could tell she was struggling for control. "Get out, Cynthia. Get out now. I already tried." Now she sounded panicked. "Everyone says a plane hit us. I can't get out, Jeff. There's fire all below us. There's no way out. No way. I'm really scared." She paused. When she resumed, her voice was strangely calm. "I called to tell you that I love you, just in case." "Go to the roof," Jeff insisted. "They'll bring helicopters to evacuate you." He gripped the telephone fiercely in his sweaty hand, trying with his voice to will her into action. "It's jammed up there. You can't get on top. We tried earlier." Her voice was desperate. "Oh, Jeff, this is what you meant." They were cut off. Jeff tried to call back, but her cell phone had no service. He snapped on the television set in his office and saw the burning towers. His team crept in a few minutes later. We didn't want to disturb you. You'd know soon enough, one said. The other stared at the screen, transfixed. Nobody listened to us. Jeff kept calling Cynthia without connecting. The three were watching as each tower in turn fell in a great, white, billowing cloud of pulverized concrete. There had been no helicopter evacuation. Jeff sat motionless. The cell phone snapped in his hand, the battery flying out and clattering onto the floor. His rage was almost more than he could stand. He wanted to kill Carlton, and in a flash, saw himself killing the director and all of the senior CIA management, too. He shot to his feet and glared at his team, wanting with all his power to strike at them, as if they were the cause. Managing to control himself, he slumped back into his seat, the rage turning on himself, for not calling Cynthia, for not saving her, for not doing enough to save anyone. He should have made someone pay attention. His assistant was right. No one had listened. Chapter 14. East China Sea. 10 miles out from Nagasaki, Japan. Tuesday, August 15, 1:03 p.m. Captain Vandana Shiva lifted the binoculars to see if he could spot the offshore facility at Nagasaki as yet. He knew it was early, but he never entirely trusted computers and the global positioning system on which they relied. He'd begun his 41-year career as a seaman aboard a traditional Indian dhoni. In his mind, that had been real seamanship, just the crew in the small boat against the ocean and wind. It had required skill and courage. It was nothing like what he did now. An uncle had liked the young Shiva, and lacking a son, financed his education. He'd done well and subsequently risen steadily in the merchant service until reaching the culmination of his career 3 years earlier, when he'd been given command of the illustrious Goddess, the largest supertanker ever built. With a crude oil cargo capacity of 600,000 DWT, or deadweight tonnage, there had never been a ship of this size in history. More than a quarter of a mile long and nearly the width of a football field, it plied the oceans at a respectable 18 knots. Because it drew more than 26 feet, few harbors in the world could accommodate the vessel, so it nearly always docked at an offshore oil facility where its enormous load of 4.5 million barrels was pumped by undersea pipe to an onshore storage facility and refining plant. This single ship contained enough energy to support a small city for 1 year. Managed with a spare crew of just 40 Filipino seamen, the illustrious Goddess was only possible because of computers and modern technology. Both were needed to design and build her. Both were essential to allow her to operate at sea. The ship had been controversial from the start, but her Hong Kong owner had insisted that she be the largest supertanker ever built. So huge was the vessel that it could not steam in the English Channel, nor could it pass through either the Suez or Panama canals. But she was entirely suited to load her cargo off the coast of Saudi Arabia at Ras Tanura, the largest such offshore oil facility in the world, then make the passage to Japan and back, at great profit to her owner. A ship of this size had had problems from the first. Initially, she'd had an unplanned vibration that was finally identified as coming from improperly designed gears. At some expense, that had been repaired. Then there'd been problems with the sides of the vessel when the ship wasn't fully loaded. They'd found it essential to maintain a proper balance of crude oil and sea pressure to prevent dangerous cracks from appearing in the structure. Next came a problem with navigation. So immense was the vessel that it had been necessary to include the Earth's rotation when calculating its route. The primary problem, though, had been control. She was pushed through the seas with just a single enormous screw, also the largest ever built. On most major ships, two screws were considered essential to allow the ship to be properly steered and stopped in an emergency. But for reasons of cost, this ship was fitted with just one. During test trials, it had proven extremely difficult to turn the ship from its course once it was at speed. Even worse, at slow speeds, it couldn't be turned at all. Nor could tugboats budge the ship when it was fully loaded. On top of that, the ship just wouldn't stop. That was an exaggeration cited by critics of the owner for pushing the envelope to this extent. But in truth, the ship was hard to stop indeed. Even with the propeller in full reverse, with the ship's inertia, it took 20 minutes and many miles to bring it to a halt. All of this caused Shiva great concern. It meant every move of the ship had to be carefully scripted. It meant always thinking far ahead. It meant that smaller vessels had to get out of its course because he had no way to keep the ship from striking them. He was certain that the illustrious goddess had sunk small fishing vessels more than once when steaming near a coastline. To perform his duty meant depending entirely on the computers to get it right. No expense had been spared in creating the finest software system a British company could design. It also meant worrying all the time, which was why he was scanning the horizon for a glimpse of the Nagasaki offshore facility. The engines should go to dead slow any minute as the illustrious goddess began to reduce speed for the docking, but the ship had to be maneuvered into exact position before he lost much headway. Once the vessel slowed to a crawl, he wouldn't be able to dock her if she wasn't properly aligned. But what bothered Shiva most of all was that technically even major storms were supposed to be of little concern as the loaded ship unnaturally rode the heaviest waves with scarcely any effect. To Shiva, that was wrong. The sea was the master, always. A ship of this size was arrogance. It showed a contempt for the ocean, and from that could only come a great harm. "Sonny," Shiva said, "do you have it on radar?" Sonny Olivera glanced up. "Yes, Captain, I've got it." "Well, I don't. There's a haze blocking it from view. Renato, shouldn't the engines be a dead slow?" The helmsman, Renato Arroyo, scanned the dials. "I think so, Captain, any second now." 3 minutes passed with no change. "This is cutting it close," Shiva said. "What does the GPS show?" "There's no alert, sir. All's normal," Olivera said. The ship continued plowing through the choppy seas as if in the middle of the Indian Ocean. "This isn't right," Shiva said finally, his seaman's instincts telling him something was wrong. "We should be slowing by now. How far are we out?" 15 clicks, sir," Olivera answered, his voice no longer unconcerned. Shiva considered the situation. "The engines should have gone to reduced speed at 18 kilometers. Check the computers." After a moment, "No more reading, sir." Shiva began to sweat. They were well overdue to reduce speed. Aimed straight at Nagasaki Harbor and land, they were going at 18 knots. But if he went to manual, could he pull this off? He could slow the ship, but he doubted very much he could make the turn and bring it to a halt within the prescribed circle for the offshore facility to do its job. He'd never done it before, and was certain he couldn't do it without a computer. But what choice did he have? "Take the computer offline. We're going manual. Helmsman, dead slow." "Yes, sir," Olivera answered, glancing nervously at his captain. Shiva felt no change in the ship. "Sonny, are we manual yet? Hurry." "Captain, the computer is locked." Olivera looked up in a panic. "It won't take a command." "Try again." "No change, sir." Olivera's voice rose. "It won't accept a command." Shiva could see the offshore facility now, shimmering in the distance. Behind it was the mainland and the city itself. He began to sweat profusely. If he turned off the computer, he wasn't certain he could command the ship. Even on manual, the commands were sent electronically. Nothing was connected directly by wire or cable, as in the old days. There was an override system, he knew, but he'd never used it before. "Captain," Arroyo's voice was urgent. Being in command meant Shiva had to command. That was the single truth he'd been taught over the years. Right or wrong, the captain gave orders. "Turn off the computer."
"Sir?"
Olivera said in disbelief. "Hurry, turn it off. We have to go manual." A moment later, Sonny said, "It's off. It wouldn't take the shutdown commands, so I had to kill the power." "Dead stop, Renato," Shiva ordered.
"Dead stop, sir."
Arroyo took the control in his sweaty palm and rang the command. The engines continued throbbing unchanged. "Do it again," Shiva ordered, fighting to remain calm. The offshore facility was looming far too close on the horizon. Arroyo sent the order again. Nothing. "How far are we out?" Shiva asked, willing himself to remain calm. The captain must never panic.
"GPS is down with the computer off, sir," Olivera answered.
"Hard to port," Shiva ordered. If he couldn't slow the ship, he needed to head it in a safe direction.
"Hard to port, Captain," Arroyo repeated as he spun the wheel.
"Sir, nothing. I've got no control. It's just spinning in place." The illustrious goddess continued at 18 knots like an arrow, straight at the offshore facility and the port beyond. Shiva estimated the distance at under 10 kilometers. Even if he had control, he couldn't stop the ship in time.
"Full reverse," Shiva ordered.
Arroyo moved the control.
"Full reverse, sir."
Nothing. The engines continued as before. The ship plunged ahead without alteration.
Turn the computer back on. Reboot. Hurry. Sonny, hurry.
A long minute passed.
The computer's frozen, sir. It's locked.
Do it again and keep doing it until we have control.
Captain, we're almost there, Arroyo screamed.
Desperate, Chiva radioed the offshore facility and the port that he had no control over the ship. A small Japanese naval ship came out and signaled frantically for him to stop, but he could do nothing. 1 mile out, the computer was still locked and steering was unresponsive. Chiva sounded the horn as warning over and over. The deep, resonant blast reverberated like the voice of God as the ship moved across the ocean. But it did no good, except to draw a crowd of workers on the facility to the rail and members of his own crew to the deck. The massive ship passed the floating facility with 50 feet to spare, though they cut several oil lines and crushed at least one small tender tied to a moorage. Chiva could now see the port.
My God, he muttered. Sonny, you still can't get the computer up?
No, sir. It's just locked over and over. Oliveira looked up from his screen at the reality beyond the windshield. His face was dripping in sweat.
What's going to happen?
4 minutes after rushing by the offshore facility, the illustrious goddess roared into Nagasaki Harbor, smaller ships scattering in every direction. The enormous ship made the sound of an onrushing locomotive until it struck bottom more than 100 yards out. But with its mass plus the surge of the engines continuing without respite, the ship plowed ahead as if nothing had happened. Like a mammoth battering ram, it streaked across the harbor, then struck land, continuing almost without let-up until two-thirds of the ship was out of the water. The sounds of twisted and torn metal were horrifying. Crossing the port, the massive ship killed 6 men who'd been too slow to move. Chiva and his disbelieving crew were knocked to the deck by the force of the impact. A deep moan came from within the ship. The ship's screw continued to turn and turn, the water behind it boiling into a chocolate-colored froth. Out of the water, without the pressure of the ocean, the sides of the ship ruptured, and 4.5 million barrels of oil began surging out. Chapter 15. Manhattan, New York City. World Trade Center site. Tuesday, August 15, 12:38 p.m. Jeff's decision to form his own computer security company when he left the government had been logical and, for the most part, satisfying. His involvement in the events leading up to 9/11 were known to only a few within the company, who certainly had reason not to brag about his discoveries. The veil of secrecy over his work at the CIA also prevented him from going public with the details, though he'd come to accept that it would have done no good if he had. Instead, he plunged into the world of cybersecurity, where he believed he could do some good. He knew the government was where he belonged, but it was too mired in bureaucracy for him to be effective. Perhaps he could attack the problem from the private sector and make a good living at the same time. From his experience, the level of security for most computers, even those for otherwise quite sophisticated businesses, was paper thin. Their security programs weren't updated routinely or even activated, and patches released for vulnerabilities were often not installed. In the worst-case scenarios, viruses propagated at an alarming rate. SQL Slammer, a virus released in early 2003, doubled every 8.5 seconds and infected 90% of vulnerable hosts within 10 minutes. It was responsible directly and indirectly for shutting down 13,000 Bank of America ATMs. A more recent high-profile example was the Conficker worm. It was originally launched by as-yet-unidentified hackers in late 2008 to serve as a general-purpose platform for malicious activity ranging from spamming to denial-of-service attacks. By constantly updating to use increasingly more sophisticated update, propagation, and rootkit techniques, it had managed to infect an unknown number of computers with estimates as high as 15 million. Every year, every few weeks, in fact, more and more viruses were unleashed, and increasingly they were searching for ways to steal money. One-third of the U.S. workforce was online, while millions more banked in cyberspace. Internet crime had outgrown illegal drug sales, netting more than $120 billion annually. There had been nearly 200 major intrusions into corporate computers, exposing more than 70 million Americans to financial fraud. This included everything from dates of birth and social security numbers to credit card numbers and passwords. Ford Motor Company had had the records of 80,000 employees stolen online. Worse, the numbers were likely far greater, since so many individuals and companies had no idea their systems had been hacked. The government was largely unconcerned, or unknowing, for the DHS research budget for cybersecurity had been cut to just $16 million. Basically, it's so damn simple, Jeff thought. Viruses found their path into computers in two ways. They could enter through a vulnerability in an application or within the operating system itself, or they could inadvertently be downloaded by the computer user, who was tricked into manually running the virus, believing it was something it was not. Regardless of the method for contamination, the virus would make its way freely into thousands of computers undetected before one of the security company's honeypots, computers left online with no protection, attracted the virus. Thereafter, it could take several hours to several days for an antivirus company to create a signature and deliver it, known as a rollout, to their customers. Once loaded, antivirus software prevented the virus from executing, so the user with the program installed was safe against the virus, no matter how the contamination occurred. The antivirus software on customer systems usually checked for the upgrades once per day, though automatic updates were often never turned on by owners. When a virus that exploited a new vulnerability was discovered, the antivirus company also notified the software vendor whose product contained the vulnerability so it could prepare a fix known as a patch. To create, test, and make the patch available, the vendor would take anywhere from a few days, in the most critical cases, to weeks or even months for vulnerabilities that were less critical. In both cases, the patch was rolled out to customers over a period of days. It could be months before most customers installed the patch, and many companies or individuals never installed it at all. When a particularly risky vulnerability was identified, vendors sent security bulletins to customers, advising them to manually download and apply the patch rather than wait for the automated update. The security companies were always playing catch-up. A new risk existed for a minimum of a few days to weeks. The system, if that's what it could be called, left a surprisingly large number of computers susceptible, even to viruses that had long been identified. The situation was magnified because most home users didn't possess a security system, and if they did, they let its license expire, leaving the system exposed. Government computers were no less vulnerable. It was well known that the Chinese had obtained an enormous amount of U.S. national security data by entering computers believed to be secure. Other governments were doing the same thing. It was cheaper and more effective to hire hackers to work the Internet than to recruit, train, and support spies or to pay traitors. Because of all this, Jeff had no lack of work, particularly since his reputation preceded him into the market. Increasingly, however, he was seeing malware that traveled under the radar, destructive code that insinuated itself into computers without detection. It wasn't necessary to open an email or even to neglect your antivirus software. All you had to do was connect to the Internet, and the malware found you if you had a vulnerability. The truly destructive viruses, those that stole financial records, destroyed systems and such, were more often like subterranean trolls. They were unleashed by their creators or by someone working with them and flashed across the core of the Internet, seeking a way to enter a computer by exploiting a vulnerability, an error, or pathway inadvertently left open in one of its programs. The viruses were always there, permanent, relentless. They never tired, never became frustrated, required no fresh direction. As they pressed their electronic nose to the security wall of each computer, they probed for that little mistake written into a program that allowed them to gain entry, undetected, undeflected by firewalls or antivirus programs. These worms descended to the depths of the computer, burrowing down and existing like a living parasite, planting themselves within the operating system. They were designed to resist detection. To mask themselves further, they worked slowly at replicating clones, sending out new versions of themselves to seek new computers at an all but undetectable rate. They were a cancer on the Internet and on every computer they entered. They grew, spreading their electronic web into every space they could find. This was the future of all serious malware, one increasingly concealed from detection by a cloaking technology known as rootkits. Yet years after the tragedy of 9/11, the FBI was claiming that Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups lacked the ability to attack America's cyber infrastructure. They didn't say the system was safe. No, they said that the terrorists didn't have the ability to exploit it. Yet. Bringing his thoughts back to the present, Jeff stepped from the subway station onto the sidewalk and stopped. He blinked his eyes at the sudden light, trying to take it all in. The sight of nothingness where the World Trade Center had once stood, dominating the landscape, stunned him. To his right, still erect and fully functioning, was the World Financial Center. Except for broken windows and some concern about foundations in the weeks after the attack, it had emerged unscathed. Account resources management was up and running after a 6-month hiatus in Upper Manhattan. The company lost 3 employees that day, Cynthia and another co-worker attending a meeting near the top of the North Tower, plus one who was arriving late for work and was struck by debris from United Flight 175 when it hit the South Tower. There had been a memorial service, but Jeff had been too overwhelmed with grief, loss, and culpability to attend. For the same reason, he'd not gone to the service the family held in Cookeville, Tennessee. Now, though, his anger was all on himself, and his burden of guilt was almost more than he could bear. He simply could not face it. He walked at a steady pace around the enclosed site. With each step, he found the enormity of the devastation overwhelming. To see it on television and in pictures was one thing. To be here, to see it like this, was something else entirely. From time to time, he came upon memorials, some official, most impromptu, commemorating the loss of one group or another. At the poster of 3 Brooklyn firefighters raising the American flag over the rubble that terrible morning, Jeff stopped. What was the point in walking? What did he think he was accomplishing? Jeff gazed into the gaping chasm. Cynthia's body was never recovered. Whatever there had been of her lay there, before him. He closed his eyes and wept. Chapter 16. Istanbul, Turkey. Sefakoy District. Istanbul Technical University. Tuesday, August 15, 3:11 p.m. Like most of the other students, Mizut Elatuntas worked on his own laptop at the University Computer Science Center. The university had an excellent computer program, which was why he went there. They provided this room on campus where students could access the internet with their own computers, since many of them didn't have internet access at home. The room might have been on any college campus anywhere in Europe or America, except here in Turkey. The air was thick with the fog of cigarette smoke. Elatuntas scrolled down the list of websites produced by his Google search. He was already familiar with several of them and knew they were of no use to him. Others weren't related to the code he was searching for. He'd already used one that suited his purpose. Now he wanted another very like it. He pursed his lips and continued to scroll. At first, the idea of constructing new viruses had seemed simple enough. He designed a few himself and considered releasing them, but the arrest here in Istanbul of the cracker with the screen name Coder had made him cautious. Coder had bragged to everyone in various chat rooms how easy writing virus code was and how you could make money at it. Now he was in jail. Sure, his real name had appeared in newspapers and on television around the world, but that wasn't the kind of fame Elatuntas sought. But right now he needed a new base virus code. He already had the code for turning systems off and on. When he'd been given it, he'd had no idea what it did. But he'd spent some time studying the code and was now certain. At first, it had scared the hell out of him. But once he realized that he was covering his tracks in ways that hadn't occurred to Coder, he'd been thrilled at the possibilities. Someone was up to something big and he was a part of it. Elatuntas needed to place that code into a virus with a proven record of exploitation. His employer paid a flat 100 euros for each new virus Elatuntas produced, but added another 100 if it had a larger-than-average degree of exploitation. Elatuntas didn't know how his employer made that determination, but he'd been paid the extra 100 often enough these past weeks to figure his employer knew how to do it. There. StopHackers.com. Crackers posted their virus codes in many places, but Elatuntas had learned that websites that claimed to be fighting malware were actually a great source for the code. He suspected they actually existed for the purpose of disseminating it. It was posted right there on the website. Anyone could help himself. Now that he'd copped the most obvious viruses and knew the remaining common viruses and their variants, he'd already used the best. Finding something for which a security patch didn't yet exist was his dream. But he'd settle for a new virus or variant of an old standby that looked to have fresh access. StopHackers.com was a new website, Teletuntas. He scrolled through the boilerplate that the webmaster had lifted from similar sites, then entered a chat room, discussing various viruses at length. He found a lot of chatter about a new one out of Manila, home of a love bug called Doomer. It was a network worm, which meant no attachment had to be opened for it to enter a computer, and gained access by exploiting a vulnerability in Windows XP. Excellent. But the best news was that Microsoft had yet to announce a patch. That meant he would likely have at least a month of smooth sailing and an extra 100 euros in his account. None of this bothered him in the least. Since he'd been a small child, he'd enjoyed breaking things. Too often he'd been caught and punished. Now, on the Internet, he could smash the biggest of things and never be caught. He found it thrilling. Elotuntas copied the code, then dropped it into his own cracker file. He studied the new virus for a few minutes, but didn't understand it. The inventor had been clever. Mentally shrugging, he searched for the point where he could insert his new code so that it rode piggyback into computers along with the virus. Shit. He went back to the website and read the entries in the chat room carefully. 30 minutes later, he found what he was looking for. Stupid. I should have spotted that on my own. Back into his own file, he pasted his own code into the location, tailor-made, it seemed, for just such an addition. Let's see. He customized the code he'd copied to infect an unattended computer, then downloaded the virus. The girl who owned it, Melek, had asked him to keep an eye on her laptop while she went out for lunch. He'd smiled and agreed. A few seconds later, the worm announced it had successfully dropped itself on the target. It had taken. Excellent. Back at his own computer, he sent an email from his Yahoo account. Date, Tuesday, 15 August, 1556, 0800. He typed in the address. From Wise Guy, wiseguy17@yahoo.com. Subject, new code. Have the code inserted in new Doomer. It tests. Is attached. When will you send money? Do you want more? Wise Guy. Elotuntas attached the new file and watched the Yahoo email account go through its virus scan with some amusement. He hit return to message and sent the virus. He checked back later that day for his answer. Then he spent the next 20 minutes searching for another virus for his new code to piggyback on, certain he'd have a use for it. Melek returned to her computer. Sadul, she told Elotuntas with a smile. He smiled back. She'd never know how she'd just thanked him for what he'd placed into her computer, not unless she was secretly controlling a nuclear power plant. Chapter 17. Manhattan, New York City, IT Center, Fisherman, Platt & Cohen, Tuesday, August 15, 6:09 p.m. Jeff walked to the law firm's building from his hotel, enjoying Manhattan in the early evening hours of a late summer day. He passed joggers, restaurant owners setting up chairs and tables outside, office workers rushing home or to join someone for a drink and conversation. Picking up a double latte and toasted bagel, he crossed the marble lobby, then took the elevator to the law firm's offices on the 22nd floor. He entered the IT center quietly in the event Sue was asleep, but found himself alone. Jeff took his place and inserted the driver in the virtual machine. To see what the driver was doing, however, Jeff needed to use a kernel debugger. He set breakpoints so that the machine would stop when it reached points where Jeff believed he might be able to study the driver's operation. Going this far was both good and bad. Good in the sense he hoped to produce something useful. Bad in that he was forced to go so far searching for answers. But something important was eluding him. Perhaps more than a single something. The only truly good thing about all this he could point to was that Daryl was at least as fully engaged, and she had far greater resources than he did. The system ran a moment, then Windows hit a breakpoint, and the debugger stopped the virtual machine, putting it in a form of electronic suspended animation. Jeff read the script, then entered a G for go to allow the driver to continue. A few minutes later, he reached his fourth breakpoint. Examining the standard Windows system data structures on the screen, Jeff noticed that the driver had made modifications to the control flow of several functions used by applications to list the drivers loaded on a system. He launched a device driver listing diagnostic tool, but saw no sign of the driver he was studying. The driver had intercepted the utilities query and stripped the driver from the list before returning the data. "Shit," he muttered under his breath. "The bastard's using a rootkit." Once rare, rootkits were becoming increasingly common in malware, since they allowed malware to be hidden from security tools. With a sinking heart, he understood now what he was up against. Part of the virus, or another one altogether, was hidden from him. Rootkits weren't limited to malware. In 2005, Sony had released a range of CDs that were designed to prevent excessive duplication. The end-user license agreement accompanying them was not complete, and that it failed to inform customers that the CD was installing a rootkit onto their personal computer. More than 2 million CDs were shipped with the rootkit, promptly dubbed malware by computer experts who detected its presence. More than 500,000 customers innocently placed the hidden code deep within their computer's operating system. The affair turned into a fiasco for Sony. Early attempts to delete the rootkit disabled the computer's ability to play any CD and, worse, caused the computer to crash. The rootkit was also not very well written. Hackers soon found they could attach viruses to it, using Sony's own software to cloak them from detection. Sony was forced by a public uproar to recall the CDs and make a removal patch available, but the harm to the company's reputation was done. A major international corporation had publicly been branded with employing hacker code. The long-term consequences were incalculable. Jeff ran a rootkit detection program, then cursed again. There on the screen was the unmistakable evidence of the rootkit. He'd seen the behavior. Now he had confirmation. As a cloaking technology, rootkits work by hiding files, registry keys, and other objects in the system in the kernel mode of Windows. When a user ran a standard detection program to see what programs were operating, the rootkit had many ways to remove the program it was concealing from the list being generated. In this case, the program being cloaked was the virus. The next step was to run a number of advanced security tools, searching for evidence of code that would activate the rootkit at each booting. It came up empty. Then Jeff dumped the service table contents, studying them carefully. Each should point at addresses within the Windows kernel, but within minutes he found two that did not. One of the intercepting functions was part of the IPSE-CNAT.SYS device driver that he had been studying. Now he knew which driver implemented cloaking. "At least now I can see if I can disable the cloak and expose whatever it's hiding," Jeff thought. Opening a command prompt, Jeff entered the hidden directory. The sophistication of this rootkit was troubling, he realized, especially when compared to what appeared to be the cut-and-paste construction of the part of the actual virus he'd examined so far. The rootkit was lean and cleverly fabricated. Jeff paused for a moment to reflect. What the malware was suggesting to him was at least two creators. That might be significant, then again it might not. A basic cracker might have created the virus, then found the slick rootkit to hide it. He couldn't imagine anyone skilled enough to build this rootkit unleashing such a hack job of a virus. He wouldn't be able to resist cleansing the code. What if they're working together, he thought, wondering what the implications of that might be. Jeff took a moment to text Daryl, informing her of the rootkit. A few minutes later, she responded with a single word. "Shit." No kidding, Jeff thought, before turning back to his work. Next, he stepped instruction by instruction through the driver, trying to discern the goal of the virus, without luck. Then it occurred to him there might be more than one, so he examined the assembly language he generated earlier. This was extraordinarily time-consuming. Long, exhausting hours dragged by as he threw himself into the brain-taxing exercise. When he could go on no longer, he slept on the couch rather than return to his hotel. At some point, Sue returned. Harold appeared and began bringing them food at regular intervals, though Jeff couldn't have told anyone what he ate if his life depended on it. One of the major problems he was up against, Jeff realized, was that he couldn't tell what kind of external influences were normally involved in this suspect driver's operation. Perhaps the driver had a helper program or some other external stimuli that caused its payload to trigger. Or it might have been something within the virus code itself, even a standard mechanism in the computer's operating system. So far, he'd found nothing to tell him why the virus had been unleashed, nor anything to hint at what the purpose had been beyond simple destruction. Was this a financial operation launched by Russians? Or had it been a simple shotgun attack meant to cause immediate widespread destruction? He simply couldn't tell. He was burrowing deeper and deeper into decrypting the driver, but still lacked the answers he sought to tell him how the virus actually ran when it was live. Just when he thought he wouldn't be able to restrain himself from picking up the computer and throwing it across the room, Jeff came across something that promised to be interesting. Even though the driver had decrypted much of itself when it launched, it still left pieces of itself encrypted. With some effort, he coaxed the driver into executing certain code sequences that decrypted more of itself. The newly decrypted code sequence referred to another driver with a more sinister name, bioswipe.sys, that it expected to be able to extract from itself and execute. However, the second driver wasn't in the driver file he had, nor in the corrupted installation when he went back to look for it. BIOS, or the Basic Input-Output System, was the code programmed into the computer itself that started the computer and was responsible for reading the initial part of the operating system code from the first sector of the hard disk into memory and executing it. Modern computers had BIOS that could be flashed or reprogrammed with new instructions. Computer manufacturers sometimes made BIOS updates available that fixed bugs or improved the computer's startup performance. But a virus that knew how to reprogram the BIOS could erase its contents, making the computer unbootable. Repairing such a computer was tedious and sometimes even impossible. Part of this virus was missing, he realized, either because it had already been deleted or because it wasn't part of the variant installed on the law firm computer. Still, the sheer scope of this attack on a system with all the standard safeguards in place was astounding and underlined the enormity of the problem he faced. Sue took a break, then returned freshly scrubbed, munching on a candy bar. Still at it, I see? Did you read about that ship in Japan? No, what happened? Its computer guidance and navigation systems failed. The ship slammed into Nagasaki, killing some people. I saw a video. The harbor is just filled with crude oil. There's speculation it was a virus of some kind. What do you think?
It's possible, but there's no way of telling if it's what we have here.
Okay, expert, what can you tell me?
Matter-of-factly, Jeff walked her through what he'd uncovered.
I'm confused, she said, wadding up the candy bar wrapper and pitching it toward the trash basket, missing by a foot. Does it want to steal our financial information, destroy our records, or destroy our computers?
Good questions all. The answer is, I don't know.
Jeff frowned. I've seen no evidence of stealing information, but it both destroyed records and destroyed computers. It's malicious and destructive, but from what I can see, it's got no clear purpose.
What triggered it?
Sue looked every bit as confused as Jeff felt.
He shook his head. I don't know.
Can you find it in our backup? I'm under a great deal of pressure here. Clients have figured out we've got a problem and are threatening to leave.
Her face was creased with concern.
Jeff hesitated. I should be able to locate what I found here, but it's like proving a negative. If I find it, then the backup records are tainted and of no use. But if I don't find what I've got here, that doesn't necessarily mean something else isn't buried somewhere. I have no sense of how much I've discovered, and I'm almost certain to have missed something. I'm beginning to think there are at least two viruses here, and I'm dealing with cloaking. A great deal could still be concealed from me.
But if you find nothing, that's a good sign?
Jeff understood Sue's need to get this problem solved. Her job likely depended on it. He wanted to sound encouraging, but experience taught him otherwise. Cautiously, he said,
Yes, as far as it goes, you could make a copy of the backup. I'll check it for what I've learned. If it seems clean, or if I delete the evidence of what I've learned here, I might disable the viruses, allowing you to boot up and see what you've got.
Sue brightened. I like the sound of that.
Don't get your hopes up too far. That's going to eat up a lot of time with no guarantee. I'd feel better if I knew more.
If you crack this too late to do us any good, what's the point?
Jeff hesitated.
There may be clues in the calling cards the crackers left in his code. If we know more, maybe we can determine if the backup is secure before putting in all that time.
Sue stared at him a moment, then seemed to reach a conclusion.
Super freak. My guess is that's our key.